This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The songs of Candor and Ebb are being celebrated off-Broadway in a new review called And the World Goes Round. New York Times theater critic Frank Rich raved about the show and described the Candor and Ebb aesthetic as splashy showbiz emotions emblemized by hyperbolic anthems of survival. That kind of anthem is best epitomized by one of their most popular songs, New York, New York. In their 25-year collaboration, John Candor and Fred Ebb have written the songs for the musicals Cabaret, Chicago, The Act, Woman of the Year, and Flora the Red Menace. Liza Minnelli is the singer most associated with their songs. In fact, she's singing some of them now in her new show at Radio City Music Hall, which was directed by Fred Ebb. Ebb writes the lyrics, Candor the music. Before we meet John Candor, let's listen to the song that the new Off-Broadway Review takes its title from. It was written for Liza Minnelli to sing in the movie New York, New York.
Sometimes you're happy and sometimes you're sad, but the world goes wrong. Sometimes you lose every nickel you've had, but the world goes round. Sometimes your dreams get broken in pieces, but that doesn't alter a thing. Take it from me, there's still gonna be a summer, a winter, a fall and a spring. And sometimes a friend starts treating you bad, but the world goes round.
I know in talking to Stephen Sondheim that he said he didn't think he could write songs about the context of a show. That's why he doesn't write pop tunes, because the show gives you a sense of who the characters are, what kind of music is needed.
Right.
Do you feel that way, too? I mean, you've had, like, the first song that you wrote with Fred Ebb was My Coloring Book, and that was a pop hit on the radio and everything. But after that, I think virtually all the work you've done together has been for shows. Do you think you'd be writing songs if it wasn't for the context of Broadway shows?
No, I really don't. I think that when Fred and I first started working, for the first couple of years, we, in addition to being interested in the theater, we tried writing pop songs, and a few of them got performed, but for the most part, no. So I tend to agree with Stephen. We always write in some sort of context. If it's not for a show that we're writing, then it's for maybe it's a piece of special material for a couple of ladies that we're very fond of, Chita Rivera and Liza Minnelli.
Now, Fred Ebb couldn't be with us today because he's doing some last-minute work on a show. There's a run-through or something. Are you used to talking without him about your work?
No, I'm not.
Does it feel awkward?
Yeah. Fred is much more articulate than I. And usually we're in a room together. And questions get addressed to the two of us, and he will answer.
That makes it easy for you, doesn't it?
Yeah, I like it that way, too.
What is your process of working together? Do you work together in the same room at the same time?
Right. Fred lives about four blocks from my house, and he likes to stay home to work. I like to go out to work. And at 10 o'clock or so in the morning, I'll go over to his house, and we will sit around the kitchen table and have some coffee and gossip a little and then go to work. And if we're working on a moment in a show, for instance, we'll be talking about the characters and the situation that we're about to musicalize. And Fred may have an idea or a phrase, and from that phrase, maybe we'll develop a rhythm. It's very hard to describe it after that except to say that we improvise together at the same time in the same room. It's a It's a kind of unique way of working for us. Most people do not work that way. Either somebody hands somebody a melody or somebody hands somebody a lyric. That never happens to us, or almost never. And for the 26 or so years that we've been together, that's always been the way we worked. And it's always fun. I don't know how to say that without sounding goony, but it's true. Whatever else is going on in our lives, sitting together in a room and writing a song is always a good time, even when our work is bad.
Let me pick up on what you just said, even if the work is bad. Now, when do you decide that you don't like a song if you're going to tear it up? Do you know that right away, or is it like 3 days later that you realize, God, that was a bad song?
Sometimes you know it right away. Usually it takes about 24 hours. And then I'll come back the next day, we'll look at it, and we'll both stick our fingers down our throats and tear it up and go to work again. But that's never a terrible moment. I think it's very important, at least it always has been important for us to stay very loose, which allows you to write badly as well as to write well. But we write a lot, and we tear up a lot.
In some ways, I think you're best known for your anthem, songs like New York, New York, or even, And the World Goes Round, I think of as being a real anthem-like song. When you sit down to compose something that you know is going to be big and anthem-like, are you thinking about anything different than when you're sitting down to compose a ballad?
No, I think, at least speaking for myself, we just try to fill the moment. Each moment that you write for in the theater has its requirements, and you try to fulfill those requirements as honestly as you can, keeping the diction of the characters in mind and their real emotions. New York, New York is an example, though, of tearing up things and starting again. We wrote some songs for the movie New York, New York, and one of our assignments was to write a title song, and we brought it in and played it for Liza and Scorsese, and they liked it just fine. And Robert De Niro was there, who was starring in the movie, and I could see him over in the corner with Scorsese gesturing quite vehemently. And Scorsese came back and almost apologetically said that De Niro felt that the song was not a heavyweight enough song, and would we take another shot at it? Well, we were both highly insulted, of course, and we said yes, and we were being very stuffy about it. Anyway, we went home and wrote the second version of New York, New York, which is the song that became very popular. The point of that story is that if it were not for Robert De Niro, we would never have had a hit song called New York, New York.
Start spreading the news, I'm leaving today. I wanna be a part of it. New York, New York, these vagabond shoes are longing to stray and step around the heart of it. New York, New York, I want to wake up in the city that doesn't sleep, to find I'm a king of the hill, ha! Top of the heap. My little town melting away, I'll make a brand new start of it in old New York. If I can make it there, I'd make it anywhere. It's up to you, New York, New York.
Tricks to writing a big song like that, like key changes or movements up the octave or anything that you feel like you draw on when you're writing a big, triumphant kind of song?
I have absolutely no awareness of them. I'm sure there are, I'm sure there are plenty of cliches that I create for myself, but I don't know what they are. There are people who have said that there's a kind of Kander and Ebb style to a song, or they can recognize a Kander and Ebb song. Well, I couldn't. I have no idea what we do. I just know that at the end of writing a piece, I'm happy if I like it.
My guest is composer John Kander, half of the songwriting team Kander and Ebb. Their collaboration is being celebrated in a new off-Broadway review called And the World Goes Round. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. Songwriter John Kander is my guest. Now, let's get back to New York, New York. That song was written for the movie of the same name.
Right.
And, it, you know, it's a great song, but nothing much happened to it after the movie until Sinatra recorded it. How did he pick up on the song?
Damned if I know. Liza made this wonderful record of it, and I thought she sang it brilliantly in the movie and on the record. It didn't go anywhere. The song was not nominated for an Academy Award or anything like that. And that was the year that we were not nominated, and the entire score of Saturday Night Fever was also not nominated. But that's another story. Anyway, a few years later, and I don't know how he got the song, Sinatra got it, liked it, and recorded it, and performed it a lot. And I cannot tell you why his made it and Liza's didn't. That's one of those chemical things that is beyond me. At any rate, they both have done us proud, and we're very grateful for what happened to that song.
Now, you studied classical music. How did you end up writing for Broadway and writing pop?
Oh, gosh. I've always been sort of musically schizoid, I guess. I grew up loving classical music and loving the theater, too. When I was a little kid and was collecting records, I had a picture of Lotte Lehmann as the Marshal in Der Rosenkavalier on one end of my bureau, and a picture of Gertrude Lawrence in Lady in the Dark on the other end of my bureau. This is true. And I would see those two faces every morning. And I think deep down inside, I thought, if ever I run away from home, I'm going to run away to one of those two ladies, but I don't know which. And I didn't think that I was speaking to myself symbolically, but I guess I was. Then, when I was at Columbia getting my master's, the head of the music department was someone who became my very great friend and who became my family, he and his family, and that was the composer Douglas Moore, who was an opera composer. He wrote The Ballad of Baby Doe, among other wonderful things. And we spent a lot of time together, and one slightly drunken night when we were playing music back and forth, and he said, you know, if I had it to do all over again, I think I'd write for Broadway. And in a funny way, that gave me a seal of approval on a decision I think I'd probably already made subconsciously and didn't know I had.
Now, you met your partner almost on a blind date, so to speak. You
know? Sounds like it, yes.
Yeah, because you were basically set up by the music publisher Tommy Volando, who had been publishing both of you independently, and what, he suggested that you get together? Do I have the story right?
He literally said, I think you two guys should meet each other. I think you'd like each other. And so since we always followed his advice separately at the time, we did meet each other, we did like each other, and we started writing almost immediately. I don't know, we were just pregnant with song all the time, it seemed to me. And from then on, we've been one of those marriages in which you're pretty faithful to each other. Fred has done some material with someone else, and I do an occasional movie score, as I am at the moment. But when it comes down to the hardcore of what we've written, we write together.
What kind of film score are you working on now?
It's for the movie based on Billy Bathgate that Robert Benton has directed, with Dustin Hoffman and Bruce Willis.
That's great. So you're doing the score for that?
Yeah, it scares me to death.
Well, okay, you're doing the score for this, and you don't have someone to work off of, like you always work with Fred Ebb.
Well, when I'm doing a film score, I only do a film score if I know that I have a director who's going to be really generative and open with me. And I've done three movies with Robert Benton before, and he's extremely communicative and generative to me. So it's like having a collaborator.
Mm-hmm. You and Fred Ebb started writing for Broadway at a time when rock music was really displacing Broadway music as the pop music of the day. And even on Broadway, a few years after you started working, you know, shows of, like, I think of as ersatz rock music started taking over, shows like Hair. Do you feel that your kind of songwriting has been displaced at certain periods by rock music?
Well, yes, in one sense. When I was growing up, and even into the early days of my career, a great deal of what was popular music came from the theater. A hefty percentage of the song hits that swept the country came out of Broadway theater. Then, when rock music took over commercially, songs were no longer extracted from Broadway musicals. The perfect example I can give you is that when I walked into my hotel room in Boston before the first performance of Cabaret, I turned on the radio while I was unpacking, and there were 5 songs on the radio from our show. There had already been that many records made. And at the first performance, the song Cabaret was already a hit. That was the last time anything like that happened. So I guess there is pop music and there's classical music, and then somewhere in some other category there is what we would have to call theater music.
Are there really significant ways that you think Broadway or the theater has changed since you started writing?
Sure. Fred and I and Jerry Herman and Steve Sondheim and our generation were the last generation to be able to get their work done and fail and then be able to get produced again. The theater was not nearly as expensive. There were a lot of very active, very imaginative producers around. That's changed. And I can think of a number of factors. The change in the music business, of course. The skyrocketing expenses of putting on a Broadway musical compared to 25 years ago. The fact that there is only one newspaper in New York now that matters critically. Now, whoever is working at the New York Times has the power to make or break a Broadway show. So that producers are terrified to do anything that they don't feel has a good chance of getting the approval of the New York Times.
You say that you think you're in the last generation that was allowed to fail and then to keep working. What did you have that failed?
Oh, for a show we wrote, Flora of the Red Menace, was a failure. I had a show before that, before I met Fred, which was a show that Hal Prince directed. It was the first show that he directed, too. It was called A Family Affair. And that ran for just a few months. Flora ran for just a few months. But the week before Flora opened on Broadway, Hal Prince, who was the producer of it, said, no matter what happens when Flora opens, the day after that, let's get together at my house and we will talk about the next show. And the next show was Cabaret. And we did get together at his house at 4 o'clock the afternoon of the day after the opening. That's very luxurious. It wasn't unheard of at the time, but it's something which would never happen today.
Why not?
It's too expensive. To get enough people together to raise the amount of money that it takes to create a Broadway musical is so difficult that there is nobody that you would call a producer. When Hal was producer or David Merrick was producing, they had their backers and they simply called up the money that they needed for a production so they could open a show this week, and whatever the reviews said, they knew that if they had another product, they could raise the money for it. Now that's very, very difficult.
When you're writing a song, do you dream the song until it's finished?
What do you mean by that?
Well, that you go to sleep and the song keeps playing and playing as you're trying to get to sleep.
Oh, yes. That's awful. And as a matter of fact, that goes on all during rehearsal. When I go out of town with a show or even when I'm in town rehearsing, I have a tape recorder next to my bed with a lot of chamber music on it, a lot of Brahms and a lot of Mozart, a lot of Schubert, something to erase my own music from my head so that I can go to sleep. I can remember when I was conducting musicals in Stock in the 50s, whatever show I was rehearsing would go on in my head all night long, and I could not go to sleep until I'd gotten through the whole score in my head, and it was murder. I remember when I was conducting South Pacific, and I finally got a technique. I would start from the beginning of the show, but I would race the tempo, and the overture went very, in my head, went very fast. I remember Happy Talk went so fast that I almost laughed when I got to it. Finally, I'd get to the end, and then I could go to sleep.
Does it sometimes make you, like, hate the songs that you like that you're writing because you can't knock it out of your mind?
No, because something else happens, to me anyway. Once the song is written and orchestrated and performed and the show has opened, it's gone. By gone, I mean a year after a show has opened, I can practically not play a single thing from it from beginning to end without the music in front of me. And I've been playing the piano all my life.
Mm-hmm.
It's, I don't know if Freddie agrees, feels this the same way that I do. I think he does. Once you finish something and somebody has sung it, it's gone. It's not yours anymore. And consequently, when you go back and listen to it, you can either like it or not like it, just as if it were somebody else's music.
So that's nice. That means you're probably not the kind of composer who feels that a singer has to perform a song exactly the way you wrote it.
No, that in the theater, you get the performance that you want for that moment, and particularly if you've written the song to fulfill a particular moment, you know how you want it to sound. After that, it's fair game.
Well, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
It's been a pleasure talking to you, too. Thanks a lot, Terry.
Songwriter John Kander. A new review of Kander and Ebb songs is off-Broadway at the West Side Theater in Manhattan. Liza Minnelli is singing Kander and Ebb songs in her new show at Radio City Music Hall. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.